Welcome to Dr. Christina Snyder. She is professor of history at Penn State, and she has written the book Great Crossings, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves in the Age of Jackson. Dr. Snyder, thank you and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to talk about Choctaw Academy, which is a really historical place that probably a lot of people are not aware of. Before we get too far into your book and other parts of this, just talk about your general feelings about the significance of this building that we believe was a dormitory for Indians, young boys who went to school there.
Certainly. So this building was constructed in 1825. And it was the first building that was associated with Choctaw Academy. Eventually, there would be many more buildings because over the course of the next 28 years, up until 1848, there were over 600 Native American boys and men who attended this school from 17 different tribes. So, you know, this school is significant on a number of levels. First of all, it's the first school that was federally controlled for Native American people. So at that time in the early Republic, the only two schools that were controlled by the federal government were West Point and Choctaw Academy. Hmm. So it's a very interesting school. In its day, it was extremely prominent. It's been forgotten over the course of the last century and a half. But it is significant on a number of levels in terms of the convergence of Native people who came to that school, in terms of the battles over education and the place of Native Americans in the country's future, and also in terms of the politics of that era. It was a time of changing U.S. Indian policy.
As I understand it, the Choctaw Native Americans, that tribe, was not located in Kentucky. Why, first of all, were they interested in sending their boys to Kentucky? And what was the reason for this educational part of this?
Sure. Yeah, this is an interesting question. So the Choctaws are actually native to what is now Mississippi. So they are one of the largest Native peoples in the United States today. And at the time, they're also a very large tribal nation. And, you know, to understand this, it helps to understand the context of that period. So this is a period when the United States is expanding by leaps and bounds. So in 1825, Kentucky was the West. Hmm. And when the school closed in 1848, California is the West. You know, so this is a time of incredible change. Native people are highly pressured by the United States to cede more and more land. So, you know, for many Native peoples like the Choctaws, they had actually been allies of the U.S. government, had really made a decisive contribution to the War of 1812, and in fact fought alongside Andrew Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans. So, you know, they weren't inclined to battle the United States. They tried to pursue a more peaceful path of collaboration, and they tried to envision a future in which Native people would be allies and trade partners of the United States. Now, that doesn't mean they necessarily wanted to become citizens of the United States. They wanted to maintain the independence of their own nation. But they did think that young boys needed to be educated in a new kind of way, that they needed to be so highly educated that they could essentially become lawyers, that they could understand the kind of legalese of treaties and of trade agreements. So, you know, the only kind of Western schooling that was really available to the Choctaws and other Native people during this time was missionary schools. And so they did have mission schools in their own nation. But many tribal leaders were dissatisfied with those schools for a number of reasons, mostly because there was not a lot of interest in Christianity necessarily. They wanted to kind of separate Christianization from education. And that's really what Choctaw Academy offered. So they thought of it as a kind of immersive study abroad experience in the US, so in Kentucky, you know, far away, where they anticipated that the students who went there would become extremely fluent in English, and that they wouldn't be subject to the kind of proselytizing necessarily that came along with mission schools. So something that makes this school different from some of the later boarding schools that listeners might be familiar with is that it was initially voluntary. So the Choctaws, you know, negotiated with the federal government to try to create a school that they felt would serve their needs.
So the leaders of the Choctaw tribe, do I understand this right, wanted their young men, boys, to be educated, but also to continue the culture and the heritage of their tribe, of their people. Is that correct? They didn't want to lose that.
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. So they did not want to necessarily assimilate. You know, that would be the word that we might use today. They did not want that. They really wanted to maintain their own political independence and their own cultural independence. And so they felt like they needed strong leaders who could, you know, stand up to the United States, who could be counted on as interpreters, you know, who they didn't want to necessarily have to rely on white people to act as interpreters during such important things as treaty negotiations. They wanted their own people to be able to do that. So they thought this education would help the rising generation with the kinds of problems they were facing.
What kind of classes did they take? What were they learning?
A really wide range of things. So primary and secondary education is quite different now than it used to be during the early 1800s. So an academy could teach a broad range of subjects from like basic reading, writing, and arithmetic, all the way up to like the most advanced courses would be things like philosophy and Greek and Latin. So really the classes ran the gamut, and there were basically three different categories of learners at the academy. You had beginners who, again, were basically learning the three R's. You had intermediate students who would start to study English grammar and history and things like accounting. And then the most advanced students, like I said, they might study these ancient languages as well as natural and moral philosophy. And some of these students, they were extremely advanced. I mean, some of the boys and men who came to the school already knew a few languages by the time they came. So they may have already been able to speak, let's say, their own native language plus English and maybe another language, like many of them already knew French. So some of these men are incredibly accomplished linguists and learners, and some of them actually went on to study law or medicine at Transylvania University.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm fascinated also that this involved not just the Choctaw Nation, but as I understand it, a total of something like 17 tribes and white children as well from that area of Kentucky.
Yes, that's correct. So there are 17 different tribal nations that are eventually represented at Choctaw Academy. So that ranged from, you know, southern tribes like the Choctaws and Cherokees and Seminoles, all the way up to tribes who lived in the far north, like Menominees, and some plains peoples like Osages. So these folks, they don't speak the same language. They have really different cultures, you know. It's very diverse. And also some of the local whites, including, you know, fairly prominent planters sent their own children there. So it is a biracial school, and it's quite a meeting ground of different peoples.
This is amazing. Do I have this right, that there was no other place like this that would have Indians and white students under one roof learning at these levels of education?
Well, you know, it's interesting because actually there was more you know, integrated learning environments than I initially anticipated going into this project. So there's Choctaw Academy, and actually some Native students went to West Point, even in the early Republic. So, you know, some Native people are entering these spaces and, you know, going to Transylvania. Some of them are going to other colleges. So I found like incidents of students going to the University of Delaware, for example, and even places like Dartmouth. You know, I should say that, you know, one option for Native students back in their homelands were these mission schools. Another option that a few Native students pursued, or really their parents pursued, was to place them in white schools. So there were, you know, there wasn't a robust public school system at this time by any means. There were a few public schools in some states, and there were also some private schools. So some of these Native boys had gone to white school, to mostly white schools, but they had actually faced, you know, significant discrimination. And so that too was part of the appeal of Choctaw Academy, that no matter what the composition of students was, that American Indians would always be in the majority of their classrooms. So that was part of the appeal.
Can you talk about the gentleman who was the key part of this, making it Kentucky the home, Georgetown, Scott County, for Choctaw Academy?
Yes, of course. That's Richard Mentor Johnson. So Richard Mentor Johnson, I'm certain that many Kentuckians are already somewhat familiar with him. He was a longtime politician. He eventually became vice president under Martin Van Buren. He's also famous for, you know, having claimed to have killed Tecumseh at the Battle of the Thames. So he was very famous in his day, was one of the leaders of his party. And, you know, some people might think it's strange that this warrior and, you know, supposed hero of the War of 1812 became a schoolmaster, you know, to the children of his former foes. But he was very interested in the business of Indian affairs, whatever the affairs of the day were. So he was on the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He actually chaired that committee for a period of time. And so he really, you know, he was an ambitious man. He was, you know, somewhat of a corrupt politician. So he also, I mean, he understood Choctaw desires to have another venue for schooling. And his brother-in-law was also the Choctaw Indian agent, so the federally appointed liaison between the Choctaw Nation and the federal government. And so my guess is that through a kind of back channel, that his brother-in-law was connecting him with the Choctaw Nation and making this suggestion, you know, that he could develop an academy on his property in Scott County. And so, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that federal money was key to this, wasn't it? That, in terms of, from what I understand, the families didn't necessarily have to pay tuition from the Choctaw tribe, but I guess the white students did. But there was federal money supporting this.
Well, you know, an interesting thing is there is some federal money. The white students did have to pay tuition, but most of the money comes from the Indian nations themselves. Okay. So what happened was that, you know, as these Native nations negotiated treaties, they set up education funds. And so they themselves were paying, you know, the lion's share of the cost of Choctaw Academy through their own national treasuries. And that's also something that makes it different from later federally controlled schools is, you know, Native nations at least had some say in what happened to the school because they had the power of the purse.
I'm guessing there are several answers to this next question, but my question is, was this in the end a success?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this can be measured on a number of levels. I would say that everyone involved in the school learned something, but I don't think it can be considered a success necessarily. I'll kind of go through, you know, the outcome of the school. So I think one of the things that created conflict from the beginning was that the federal government and Indian nations had a different idea of what they wanted to get out of the school. So the federal government wanted friends and allies in Indian country who they thought could be amenable to U.S. policies. You know, they wanted these highly educated young men to be spokesmen, you know, on behalf of the United States, and hopefully try to, you know, enforce U.S. Indian policies within their own nations. And that really didn't happen. The tribes themselves, you know, I've already described a little bit about what they wanted out of this. They really wanted, you know, their own independence. They wanted a new generation of leaders who could, you know, help them negotiate this increasingly fraught and legalistic relationship with the United States. And I would say on that front, they're much more successful. You know, ultimately it breaks the school apart in 1848. The tribes withdraw their money. The school closes. And what happens is that most of these nations who are involved establish their own public school systems within their own nations. So, you know, they have even more controlling. And I think that they, you know, learn from the kind of what they saw as the shortcomings of Choctaw Academy to institute their own forms of education, which were more accommodating to their own goals and in many cases promoted native language retention. And they did have this generation of leaders that were quite effective advocates for their own nation. So some of these young men did become doctors and lawyers and translators and, you know, worked for their tribal governments and worked to ultimately to preserve those native goals of promoting sovereignty and cultural independence.
Well, as you know, Dr. Richardson has been working very hard to try to get the funds to rehabilitate, take care of, preserve at least this one building. Can you just speak in general terms as to why you think that's important, starting first of all with just with the people of Kentucky and also that community who probably are not aware of it?
It really is a unique site. I think it shows a different side of the history of Kentucky and of the antebellum South more generally. This is an incredibly diverse place. You know, it's a place where, you know, people there speak 18 different languages. And it was seen as an experimental place. You know, it was, I think, you know, if you want to look at the most hopeful side of it, it showed what the United States could be. You know, that is a more inclusive republic, a place of tolerance, a place of where different people could come together and pursue learning and try to think about solutions for a shared future. So, you know, I think in terms of the site itself, it's very unique. There's no other place like it in the history of antebellum America. I think that I hopefully that's a good enough take. You want to ask me another
That's good. One last thing, I want to make sure I have this right. It sounds like the Native American tribes pulled the plug on this and not necessarily the federal government, or was it both in terms of closing?
It really was the Native nations who did it. I mean, there was controversy throughout Choctaw Academy's existence. One of the things, the watershed historical events that happened while the school was open was that the Jackson administration passed the Indian Removal Act, which put into motion the Trail of Tears, which we often think of as, you know, in terms of the Cherokee Trail of Tears, but this was a blanket policy that applied to most of the tribal nations of the East, including almost all of the peoples associated with Choctaw Academy. So in the midst of all that, some people in the federal government questioned whether the federal government should even support indigenous education, you know, if they were just going to be forcibly removed. the federal government continues some level of support. Of course, Johnson is still politically prominent for most of that period, and he's a strong advocate. And so it really is the Native nations that they decide that the curriculum they felt had deteriorated over the course of the school's existence. It is true that Richard Mentor Johnson siphons money throughout the entire period of Choctaw Academy. It does get worse at the end. But essentially, you know, the Native nations themselves, they complain about the quality of the education and the corruption of the people involved. And that's why they pull the plug and decide to, take that tribal money back and invest it in education closer to home.
Well, it certainly is a fascinating moment in time. And to me, it's more than just a building, but it represents that time of, as you pointed out so well, significant change in our country and relations with the Native Americans. It's fascinating. And it's to me, it's sad that a lot of it has not been put in the history books, at least for the young people to learn about. Maybe it has, and I just don't know it, but it's fascinating.
I agree. Yeah. I think maybe one of the reasons why it has fallen through the cracks is that it doesn't necessarily fit the standard narratives that we think about in American history. You know, there's not a lot of Native American content in the history of Kentucky, you know, maybe outside of some of the early conflicts between settlers and Native nations. But, you know, this is a place in Kentucky where Native history definitely continued, you know, and had a really important role in national politics. And, you know, I think another issue at play is that this is a place where, you know, it was a place where Native nations really tried to prioritize peace and collaboration, which is a strategy they frequently used. But, you know, that is also something that doesn't necessarily make it into the history books, right? Is there's so much focus on conflict. But actually, one of the things that you can see if you take a deep look at the history of this period is that Native nations are trying really hard to find a peaceful path ahead, you know, in the face of an increasingly aggressive U.S. republic.
Dr. Christina Snyder, professor of history at Penn State, thank you very much for your time and insight. It's fascinating. And I guess time will tell if Dr. Richardson's able to preserve at least this one building that is still there that's going to, well, I guess the 200th anniversary is coming up soon. Thank you, Dr. Snyder.
Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Thank you.